In light of the crisis in Flint, Michigan, water quality is on the minds of many people today. Critics have claimed that inaction from local and state governments has caused several thousand people to be exposed to toxic levels of lead.
The corrosion's eating up the pipes, it's eating up the iron pipes, it's causing main breaks, it's causing discolored water. In about 20% of the homes, there's just too much lead.
It was my responsibility to oversee the decision that had been made regarding the transfer from DWSD to the Caradon New Water System.
On this week's Eastern Standard, water quality in Kentucky. We're interested in your questions, comments, or stories. How is the drinking water in your community? Do you have concerns about it? Write to us by email at wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Post your comment to the WEKU Facebook page or send a tweet at WEKUEST. In a little while, we'll open the phones as well. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I am John Hingsbergen. Water quality is on the minds of many people right now, so today we're going to discuss Kentucky's water supply, or actually, I guess, supplies and safety thereof. Should you be concerned with your water supply? How can you test the safety of your water? How do you know if what you are drinking, using for cooking, bathing your infants is safe? That's the topic of today's program on Eastern Standard. It's an interactive program, so we're going to invite you to be part of the conversation with your questions, your comments, your personal stories, your concerns. We'll give you the email address and the phone number in just a moment after I introduce our guests. First up, we have with us civil engineer Donna McNeil. And Donna is the compliance specialist, I guess, with the Kentucky Rural Water Association. And Donna spent years working with the state of Kentucky, managing the state's utility water programs for the Commonwealth of Kentucky.
For drinking water, yes, sir.
So very much on target with this topic of the Flint, Michigan situation. Donna, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jason Marion is a professor of environmental health sciences at Eastern Kentucky University, who focuses on water supplies and waste disposal, has his PhD from The Ohio State University. Notice I know the V belongs in there. And Jason is a native of Ohio and has been here in Kentucky for about 4 years,
And I also did my undergrad and master's at Morehead State University.
Wow, okay. And your students and you are talking about, you're always talking about water quality, I guess, but Flint, Michigan is apparently a common topic of conversation right now.
Absolutely. It really makes it better to teach the courses, for sure.
We want to hear your comments, your questions, your personal stories and concerns about water quality during this week's program. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Post on the WEKU Facebook page, send a tweet at WEKUEST. And it'll be a little bit before we put a phone call on the air, but feel free to get on the line, 800-621-8890. That's 800-621-8890. That email again, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. And before we get into a conversation with Jason Marion and Donna McNeil, in January, President Obama declared a state of emergency for Flint, Michigan, ordering federal aid for local response efforts. In one of the recent stories about that situation aired by NPR, we're told that when the government switched drinking water sources, the number of children with higher lead levels doubled. That's since 2014. And for almost 4 months now, people have been told not to drink the tap water in their community because there's too much lead in it, a very scary situation. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith filed a report just about a month ago. Who's to blame for Flint's water problems?
Karen Weaver means business. She was elected mayor of Flint in November. And in office, one of the first things she did was to declare an emergency at the city. She pushed for a similar declaration at the state and federal level. Saturday night, at Flint City Hall, she shared some good news from the White House.
I just want to say that the president has granted our request for an emergency declaration.
In an odd way, getting this federal recognition is a big win for the city, a validation of sorts. Flint's man-made disaster has been festering for more than a year. The city was being run by a state-appointed emergency manager when they made the decision to get cheaper tap water from the Flint River. After that switch, the state's environmental regulators misdirected city officials on how to treat the water. And when local pediatricians produced data showing more kids were being exposed to lead, state officials initially discredited the findings. The Department of Justice and Michigan's Attorney General are looking into the matter. In the meantime, Governor Snyder has repeatedly apologized to the people in Flint. And true to form, he's focusing on what he calls relentless positive action.
Let's focus in on there's a commitment to solve the problem in Flint. And I sincerely mean that. Hopefully you can see that. We're taking every action that within reason and actually asking people to go beyond reasonable to help address this question, because this is something nobody wanted to see ever happen, and we're doing our best to take care of it.
Snyder repeatedly takes the time to list the things the state has done since October. Tested the water at schools. State has handed out nearly 50,000 water filters and 20,000 cases of water. But
those actions were not good enough. We've worked hard, but we need to get more connection to the citizens of Flint.
More than 40% of people in Flint live in poverty. Many don't have the means to drive to a distribution center once a week and load a case or two of free bottled water in their trunks. That's why Snyder started sending teams door to door last week. He activated the Michigan National Guard and asked the federal government for help. But that's not enough for many Flint residents. Nariah Sharif was among a couple hundred protesters who gathered outside Snyder's office Thursday. She says the only thing Governor Snyder can do to appease Flint residents is to resign.
This happened under his watch. His agencies covered it up, and he could flush his apology down the toilet because that's all it's worth.
Flint Mayor Karen Weaver told residents the federal emergency declaration means the federal government, not state officials, will coordinate all disaster relief efforts.
And they will continue to assess our conditions and see what needs to happen next. The fight is not over, but this is a huge hurdle that we have surpassed.
The federal government will provide up to $5 million for free bottled water, filters, and water testing kits. But that'll barely make a dent in Flint's long-term needs. Early estimates show the damage done to the city's water infrastructure alone will be at least $760 million. For NPR News, I'm Lindsay Smith.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Water quality is our topic on this week's program. And I want to point out, Lindsay Smith from Michigan Radio, filing that report for NPR. Michigan Radio, public radio, has been a very important element in reporting this story about the crisis in Flint, Michigan. So we are very proud of our colleagues up there who are bringing this story to the nation and, of course, are working within their own community. And we've raised the question here on Eastern Standard, what about the water quality in the Commonwealth of Kentucky? On this week's program, Jason Marion, professor of environmental health sciences at EKU, and Donna McNeil from the Kentucky Rural Water Association. Jason and Donna, is our water in Kentucky safe? Are there any comparisons? Are there any concerns that Flint brings home to the Commonwealth of Kentucky?
Well, this is Jason speaking, and with respect to safety, it's a hard question to answer sometimes because we have such a big geography in this state. You know, western Kentucky is a lot different than eastern Kentucky. I think that Kentucky does have some advantages in that we have more calcium in our water, and those types of things can help reduce the amount of corrosion that they were seeing in Flint. And I think that our water treatment systems in Kentucky, I know here locally in Richmond, the thoroughness of their testing with the public utilities in the state, including the rural ones, are pretty darn good. Now, the folks in eastern Kentucky that are on their private water systems and in some of our most southeastern counties, we really don't know about the water safety for those folks because there's just been inadequate testing, and the water varies so much in the mountains, the geology is so variable, it's really hard to say without those folks being able to test their water, whether it's safe or not for them. But for the most part, our state, I think, is pretty good water, and Michigan as a whole has really good water, with the exception of the fact of the older city issue. And we might have similar issues in parts of Louisville or parts of other parts of the state, maybe parts of Ashland, where you might have some older pipes that are part of the public system. But for the most part, I think Kentucky's a lot better off, but there are going to be pockets of the state that very well may have problems just due to lack of testing. We may never know.
And Donna McNeil, having been with the state of Kentucky, did you say 30 years?
22 years.
22 years, but having been there with the 30,000-foot view, I guess, of the water situation in the Commonwealth, how do you feel about it?
Well, overall, there's a lot of protocols in place to protect the public. There are 445 drinking water systems that are regulated by federal guidelines and state guidelines. Each of those water systems has to have their source approved, and they go through a preliminary engineering report. They look at the source. There's a list of contaminants that they look at initially on these sources, whether they be groundwater or surface water. From that standpoint, the Division of Water, once those systems are approved, there's a number of contaminants that they have to sample for on an annual basis or on a cycle of up to 9 years. However, statistics in Kentucky are really good. Over 80,000 health-based tests are conducted each year on these public water systems, and Kentucky has a 99.9% compliance rate.
And but this is in the 445 systems that are regulated, right?
Yes. Over 95% of Kentucky's population are served by these water systems.
Okay, so but there's still folks who are receiving water from the systems that may not be covered in that.
Those are private systems or the individual homeowner systems. A public system is any system that serves over 25 people on a daily basis or up to 6 months.
So when we talk about Flint, Michigan, I'm assuming that there's a water treatment plant of some kind. There's a water utility of some kind in place. I assume there were people going to work there every day, and they were doing the little testing with the flasks of water or whatever processes they follow to maintain water quality. What broke down in that system?
I don't know specifically what broke down in Flint, Michigan. They switched from an existing source to an emergency source as a backup. Protocols should be in place to cover those types of treatment changes and to possibly look at those issues. In Kentucky, it is required for these water systems to seek approval before they start a new water system or put an emergency service back in force. They have to make a request through the Kentucky Division of Water in Frankfort. Along with that request, they have to provide data as to what they intend to do and how it might affect the current treatment process and the distribution systems.
I think that there's some political consequences of those actions that ought to be addressed, and I think they are coming out. Whether or not there was an actual emergency or not that would have warranted switching water supplies, I think there's some more in-depth interviews going on that issue.
Well, the report we just aired said to save money.
Absolutely.
Well, switch to the river.
Right. The Detroit Public Water System was also willing to possibly cut Flint some breaks had they actually come forward. But there are some things that could have been done to the water treatment, though, particularly the addition of an anti-corrosion agent.
Let's come back to that, and let's talk about that issue of lead pipes and older homes and all that sort of stuff, the corrosion issues. Water quality, water safety is our topic on this week's Eastern Standard, 800-621-8890. You can join us by email with your question or comment, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. It's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We're talking water quality, focusing primarily on drinking water in light of the crisis in Flint, Michigan, apparently an issue for years, at least 2 years, but apparently something that had been building up in that area, and it's now a crisis on the local level, on the state level, at the federal level. President Obama declared a state of emergency or granted a request for a federal state of emergency for Flint, Michigan just a month ago. And as a result, we decided to raise the question, what about our water quality in the Commonwealth? Commonwealth of Kentucky. You're welcome to be part of our conversation. If you have questions, concerns, stories you'd like to tell us, 800-621-8890. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST or post on the WEKU Facebook page. And we're already beginning to see some questions come in, so we'll certainly get to those very quickly. Our guests in the studio are Donna McNeil, who is a compliance specialist with the Kentucky Rural Water Association. Before that, she worked at the state for 22 years, supervising public utility water in the Commonwealth. Jason Marion is professor of environmental health sciences at EKU, focusing on water supplies and waste disposal. And Jason, I interrupted you as we were talking about the issues of Flint, Michigan, and what broke down there and the changing of the water supply. So when they changed from the previous source of water to the river water, was there something in that water that came in that affected old lead pipes or other, you know, old infrastructure?
Yeah, when they switched from using Great Lakes to a river, the river water was more corrosive, and water can be corrosive. It sounds, you know, difficult for people to understand. It's not like corrosive like acid or anything like that, but it's corrosive in the sense that metal can have chemicals in it that will leach out into the water system. And there are chemicals that we add in Kentucky that most of the water providers add. And Donna can speak more to what how to evaluate whether water is corrosive or not. But in Richmond, we add zinc orthophosphate. And I would imagine that had they done that, that could have prevented a lot of the corrosion. And once the pipes start corroding and you start disrupting stuff that's been kind of deposited on those pipes for a long time, then you create a problem that's hard to stop. And we've known about adding anti-corrosion agents like zinc orthophosphate to water for a long time. Mark Edwards, who was at Virginia Tech, who was probably the academic scientist that kind of blew the lid off the situation in Flint for the people, he was the same person involved in discovering the corrosion issues in Washington, D.C., and got Washington, D.C. to add zinc orthophosphate to their water. So that's something that they should have known, something the water plant manager may have been asking for that may have been denied. I don't know the politics or the reasoning on why an anti-corrosion agent was not added to the water supply up there. And it's something that the majority, if not all, of the utilities in Kentucky do. And I know we do it here in Richmond. You don't want lead getting in your water. And who was testing the lead out in the system? The federal lead and copper rule doesn't allow for a lot of testing out in the system. So Donna can probably speak as an engineer to the, you know, whether, what makes a water corrosive and how to evaluate it.
But it's the corrosion of the pipes. It's the water is corroding the pipes in your home or in the feeder lines that are coming to your home. It's not like lead is coming in out of the river or so from some other source.
Correct. It's reaction of the water being corrosive with the lead lines or the fixtures, some of the plumbing fixtures, or a lead service line that comes from the master meter into the home, or actually the homeowner's fixtures within their own residence. There's a couple of things that a water system, especially a treatment plant on surface water, should be doing, and that's taking a Langler index. It's recommended that be done daily. It is regulated that it be taken at least once a year, but to know what's going on in the system on a daily basis, that's one of the things that is recommended to do process control internally. That water system would be testing for their pH of the water, the temperature, and their total dissolved solids. When the raw water comes into a water system, most treatment processes, especially the surface water systems, they look at the type of water that's coming in, what the contaminants are or the components of that raw water is, and they look for the optimization of making sure that they settle out the particulates in that water.
So there's a monitoring process, what's coming in and what do we need to treat for because of what's coming in?
Right, because one of the big things you need to do is get rid of the bacteria and the viruses. That can make somebody sick right away. Cryptosporidium with Milwaukee, that's one of the things that they want to make sure that you remove these organics and particulates and whatnot so that people don't get sick immediately. One of the things they do is they'll add a coagulant, which may increase the pH or decrease the pH depending upon the water type. As you go through the chemical process, chemicals are added that may change the corrosivity of that process. That's why it's important to do, to run process control through a water treatment plant to see how that corrosivity is being managed. Then as it goes into the distribution system, is if it's managed properly, you don't have these corrosion control issues or corrosion issues. But if it should, the orthophosphates that were mentioned here is a very good choice, or any other type of inhibitor. But even those would need to be followed up with testing.
It sounds like there's so many issues that require that one have a responsible water utility in place. And again, Donna McNeil, you're telling us that 95% of Kentuckians are receiving their water from tested utilities.
Correct.
So for the most part, we're in a pretty safe environment here. Who is at risk? Who should be concerned, tuned into our program out there in our listening audience?
Well, with the lead and copper rule, that rule targets those households that are most or in older parts of a distribution system. If a homeowner has lead service lines, those are the ones that are most high at risk.
Lead service lines meaning the lines that actually come into their home from the utility.
Well, yes, the utility is responsible up to the master, up to your meter. At your meter, the homeowner is responsible for the condition of what goes on with the lead service line, if it happened to be a lead service line. A lot of those have been switched over to copper or something newer, PVC type pipe or a plastic pipe. And then also your fixtures inside your home need to be a reduced level. But one thing that a homeowner can do is flush your water. When you turn on the spigot, wait 5 seconds and let it flush out a little bit. That'll help. A lot of people do that to get cold water through the water system, but your water sets there, and as it sets there, your fixtures may be helping absorb out lead into your water if it's corrosive. And actually, there is a website that anybody can go to through the Kentucky Division of Water that you can look up the Langlar Index or the corrosivity of any public water system in the state of Kentucky.
800-621-8890 is our phone number. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com is our email address. You can send a tweet at WEKUEST. We have one question by Twitter this morning. You can post on the WEKU Facebook page, and even after the program is aired, if you're listening to the archive version of the show, feel free to have a conversation on the Facebook page if you like it. We'll make sure, if we don't already have contact information for Jason Marion and Donna McNeil, we'll make sure we have that information and links on our website at WEKU.FM. We certainly want to get to listener questions after I get through a few more of the things that kind of come to mind for myself. We all drink water. We all depend on that tap in our home. We expect that we're getting something safe. I know a friend of mine who does home inspections at one time, I talked about, you know, brown stuff coming out of my tap, and he said, well, he would never drink his water out of the tap without running it for 30 seconds before drinking it at all. There's this trend, of course, that's developed over the last, couple of decades of buying bottled water at the supermarket or wherever because people don't trust the tap water in their homes. Is that a legitimate concern? Are we better off just for drinking and cooking, going ahead and using the bottled water than using the public utility?
Yeah, you're providing some very good content for discussion. There's a lot that we can unpack.
In 3 hours from now, we'll get these answers.
Yes. Well, you've got situations in the state where a lot of people are also on groundwater, and they may have concerns about using that groundwater, and their medical, you know, folks may be advising the pediatrician or the, you know, the medical doctor dealing with a pregnant woman may suggest that they drink bottled water over public water, which may be a good recommendation in areas where you don't know the water quality, particularly the groundwater users. And I worry about those folks because in our southeasternmost part of the state, there's a lot of them that are on that. So getting bottled water in those areas, if you were to go into the back of some of the larger grocery stores or supermarkets down there, you'll see 2/3 of the real estate for storage in the back of these buildings dedicated for bottled water because of public concerns regarding groundwater. Now, from a public policy standpoint, I've been in parts of the world where everybody's going out and fetching their own water and buying their own water, and it's kind of everybody on their own. It doesn't work too well because people often can't afford it or get left out. And when you have an entire system built around everybody's kind of taking care of themselves with respect to their drinking water, you're going to have people that can't afford to do the testing themselves or can't afford the bottled water and are forced to use a public supply that's no longer able to meet the demands of the public because there's not enough people wanting to contribute to that system. And that's where we have a big problem in the United States right now. Our infrastructure is rated a D by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Our drinking water systems are in dire need of repair. And we need the ability for homeowners to think about retrofitting the pipes and plumbing in their home. So if you're in Flint, you know, you can't be suggesting to people to drink the water. And if you're in a community where you've got concerns and you can't afford to do your own test, you know, bottled water might be the option. But for a public policy standpoint, bottled water is an expensive venture. It's good for the bottled water industry. It's a very expensive venture, and it's also bad for the environment with respect to climate. You know, you're transporting bottles of water all over the place when we have an entire piped infrastructure that we put together in the 1930s and 40s.
To say nothing of the plastic in the landfills, right?
Absolutely. So there's so much we could discuss on this.
I know there are no simple answers to this, but let's say you build a brand new home or you move into a brand new home. You know, PVC pipe and copper and everything looks gorgeous and beautiful, but there's still a possibility that the feed that somewhere before getting to you, there could be some problems with what's coming. You know, the water supply feed in the public utility, or can you feel that, like in a new home, you can feel fairly safe that you're going to be avoiding any of these kinds of issues? Is it just old homes with lead pipes?
It mainly is the older homes. Many communities, I know Louisville was spending, you know, over $1 million a year as part of their annual budget replacing the lead service lines. Throughout most of the water line systems, the lead wasn't, you know, somewhere, lead wasn't common in the water system until right when you got up to the home. That was an area they didn't want the pipes to break. And then you also had lead in the homes. So throughout the service system, you know, lead usually isn't going to be a problem until it gets right up to the home. It's possible that you've got lead in some of the older systems of some of the older cities in the United States, but most of Kentucky's communities are relatively young by national standards. And with that said, most of Kentucky's systems have been designed in modern history. Much of Kentucky was on private water not too long ago. And being that Kentucky kind of got into the game a little later than some of the other states and our population's been increasing a good bit, most of Kentucky is in pretty good shape with respect to public water.
Let me ask Donna McNeil to chime in on the 37 issues we just raised here before we go back to and before we go to our listeners, because our listeners are chomping at the bit with their questions and concerns at 800-621-8890. Donna, working with Kentucky Rural Water Association, worked with the public utilities for 22 years or mm-hmm. so.
Well, I would say that Kentucky's in really good shape compared to most of the United States. It's received a B rating with the civil engineering community. One of the big pushes was Senate Bill 409. Senate Bill 409 infused over $350 million worth of grants into our Kentucky infrastructure. It set up a 15 area development districts to help with the planning process to evaluate those public water systems where the needs were for drinking water and for wastewater. That money mainly went into these infrastructure systems between the years of 2000 and 2005. Kentucky is looked at as one of the lead states in the areas of infrastructure. There are over 58,000 miles of pipe in the ground in Kentucky. You can almost take a pipe in eastern Kentucky in the Pikeville area and run it all the way out to the purchase area. The lines, part of Senate Bill 409 was to encourage regionalization and to merge and consolidate water systems for better evaluation and for what are these systems to be able to meet the Safe Drinking Water Act and the rules and regulations. So that's some of the positives that have happened in Kentucky. We were talking about 445 systems in Kentucky. 388 of those, I said, treat for lead and copper. Of those systems, there are 138 that are on surface water, whether they be a river or a lake. That's 100, but they have 177 intakes across the state. Kentucky's really abundant in water. You mentioned the groundwater systems. There's 113 groundwater treatment systems. They have 220 wells and also comprehends 16 different springs.
This is fascinating information and sounding reassuring. We certainly want to respond to listener questions and comments about water safety on this week's program. And before we take another station break, let's go ahead and respond to a couple of those questions. Actually, Tracy from Lexington called before the show and left a message asking, which I don't think we've answered yet, can individuals have their water tested by an independent agency and get a report on their water quality? Who would do that, and how much would it cost, and what diseases are linked to poor water quality? About three questions there, obviously.
Yes, anyone can have their water tested. It doesn't have to be private. It can be on public water. There is a list of certified drinking water laboratories on the website located for the Kentucky Department. It's Kentucky Department for Environmental Protection, and the Kentucky Division of Water has a list of certified laboratories for drinking water. These independent laboratories will provide the amount, what you have to do to have your water tested. The information, their contact information, is on that website.
And the prices, you know, vary depending upon what all you want to test for. So that's where it's always difficult to determine water safety is. Well, it might be within compliance with the regulations that you tested for, but then there's always all these other chemicals that we could test for. So,
is there a public agency you can call on that will do it for free?
Unfortunately, in the United States, the vast majority of our public agencies do not provide private water testing free of charge. Now, when people are getting a new well or something constructed, often the health department, they may even charge a $10 fee, but they're only looking for maybe fecal matter, fecal coliforms, maybe nitrates in that county if fertilizer is an issue. So to get to the health effects that the speaker or the caller was asking about, you know, you can get anything from diarrheal illnesses, from bacteria, viruses, protozoans, from drinking water that's contaminated with often, you know, fecal organisms. You want to talk too much about those on the call, but the disinfectants can usually do a pretty good job removing those. And then you got all the chronic health effects, neurological problems from lead exposure, especially at younger ages. Chlorine disinfectants have there's disinfection byproducts that are produced. Most of the state does pretty well complying with it. There are a few health district or a few water districts that struggle with the disinfection byproduct rule, and those can cause cancer if they're not kept below the EPA limits.
So many terms, so many chemical names,
yes,
and
so
forth
much.
That you can understand why we need to rely on experts to help us out with these issues. I got a list of questions here from listeners who've texted or emailed or tweeted, and a number of folks waiting on the line. So we're going to get to those folks after we take a short break. This is Eastern Standard in light of the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. What is the situation of water quality in the Commonwealth of Kentucky? We're interested in your questions, your comments, your stories. Our guests are telling us that, in general, we're in pretty good shape in Kentucky, but we're certainly glad to respond to your questions at 800-621-8890, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Water quality in the Commonwealth of Kentucky is our topic on this week's program. The final segment of this week's show, you're welcome to be part of the conversation and interact with Jason Marion, Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at Eastern Kentucky University, and Donna McNeil from the Kentucky Rural Water Association, 800-621-8890. Email us, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Now let's go ahead to the telephone, and let's go to line two and see if Max from Nicholasville is still on the line. Max, you've probably been there for a little while. Thank you so much for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks a lot. I only drink water from the tap and coffee, but I've read and heard that two-thirds of our water sanitation engineers are going to retire over the next decade. Is that a problem?
Absolutely. This is Jason. It's not just the water sanitation engineers. It's also the environmental health professionals. And I'm president of a group called the Association of Environmental Health Economic Programs, and we are actually funded by the CDC, that group. We get grant money to actually try to increase the number of people going into environmental health and public health related fields that involve science. And you are absolutely right. It's something that the federal government has realized and is trying to put a little bit of cash into, at least to let people know. But you're absolutely right. If those positions aren't filled, we'll have to figure out how to do some more on-the-job training. But the lack of scientists and engineers that we grow here at home in the United States is a larger and bigger issue that we need to address. We have a great education system. It's just many of our students here in the state of Kentucky, as well as the U.S., are domestic students, you know, U.S.-born folks for whatever reason. Science is something that scares them, but it's something that I think when you're a child, it's something everybody wants to do. So it's an excellent question. It's an excellent point, and it's noted that we do need to address that.
And Donna, you're one of those folks who went into the civil engineering.
Yes, I did.
With an interest in this very area.
Yes. Actually, the Department for Environmental Protection sponsored me to go back to school to receive my engineering degree, which I greatly appreciated. In Kentucky, our workforce is changing in this industry, you are correct. The thing to remember also is that there is a group of professionals that are drinking water and wastewater utility operators, and these operators have to be certified for the classification of water treatment plant or distribution system in the state. This workforce is changing, and parts of the state have a difficult time getting qualified personnel to manage their systems.
Max, thank you so much for raising your question. We're going to move on because we have other questions waiting. 800-621-8890, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com, and you can tweet at WEKUEST. And Brittany from Berea wrote to us by email saying, I tweeted, but it was rather long, so I thought I'd consolidate. She says, we've lived in the city of Berea for over 4 years, and since purchasing our home in 2011, there have been leaks from our neighborhood's main line. We've heard reports from neighbors living here longer than we have that the water pressure had become abysmal. The city has patched and half-heartedly repaired the line off and on over this time period. However, in the last year, it's become much worse. We were approached by the Municipal Utility District regarding a replacement of the 1.5-inch line to a 6-inch line in August of last year. The only change that happened since is the leaks in the cracks of the pavement have gotten worse. Our pressure is lower day by day. Countless gallons are wasted down the drainage ditches in the neighborhood. There are many frustrating aspects to this situation, not the least of which is how flippant, lazy, and cheap Berea Municipal Utilities has been with the health of our family and our neighbors. 2 weeks ago, we called the roads department to have them look at the most recent patch that was done, as it has dropped about 1.5 inches. The director of the roads and water department came out, looked at the patch, and put some cones up. She says, frankly, it is unacceptable to be so flippant with the health of residents, taxpayers, and paying customers. Brittany says, considering the fact that I'm pregnant with our first child and due in roughly a week, we've been purchasing and drinking bottled water for several months now. The city may not be concerned with our health, but we sure are. Okay, Brittany, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. Not sure if there's anything much.
Yeah, well, her situation, it's something that I periodically get emails from other parts of the state. Just yesterday, there were some folks from Martin County that had sent a picture of some water coming out of a tap where it was orange, and it ran orange for quite some time, and it was indicative of a recent line failure. And line failures are something that are going to happen when you've got, especially near roads, or if lines are running over roads and they weren't properly packed with sand and different things to protect the line. So, but as pipes get older, they're more likely to break as well. In Berea's situation, it may not necessarily be that the city itself is not concerned about the health of the people, but is more or less the I don't know the situation, how they budget their funds down there, but many of these water utilities are operating at not-for-profit. The executive director and the people that work for the payroll or work on payroll on these are not—they're not—they're not making a lot of money. They're making a decent living, but they're not making a whole heck of a lot. And many of these utilities are struggling to get by. They don't make money. Most of them are not for profit. You have some for profit water providers in the state. I think Kentucky Utilities in Lexington is a for profit entity, but most of them are not for profit. And I'm not for sure if Kentucky American. I think they're a for profit company. I'm not for sure though. But many of them are struggling to meet their infrastructure demands. It's hard for them to ask for a rate increase, and many of them also have to comply with wastewater laws that keep sewage out of our streams. And a lot of these communities struggle to comply with all the regulations and are able to afford it. And the regulations are good for public health, but they cost money, and many people don't want to pay it.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU station. Let's go back to the phone and talk to Dan from Lexington. Dan, you're on the air. Go right ahead. You're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, gladly.
This is really kind of follows up on just the conversation just now. I had 2 points. One is that the situation in Flint is really quite a partisan issue. I noticed that Michigan Public Radio didn't really hit on that very squarely, and they probably aren't allowed to. But, I mean, you have a Republican governor who, in order to provide better city services or control the costs in a very poor city, imposed the choice of turning to the Flint River on that community. So this is really done by the governor, and that's the reason people there are so angry. But the other thing I was going to say is that in southeastern Kentucky, as the professor has just said, there's really a lot of problems with drinking water where people have their own water supplies coming out of the groundwater. That's caused by mountaintop removal and by other mining practices. And I'm wondering, again, I just heard just a moment before the beginning of your program that Governor Bevin is cutting the budget of the office that's supposed to be looking after these environmental affairs by 9%. 4.5% this year and 9% in the years going out. And I'm just wondering the extent to which official, the cabinet person in charge, is going to be able to really keep an eye on water in private water systems.
Donna worked for the state for 22 years. Are you able to say anything about the level of the ability for that office to operate, especially under budget cuts?
The main point is to protect public health. I know when I was there, I would do everything I could to protect the public health. Complaints, as we heard from the last email that you got, is a major concern. The budget cuts affecting the Kentucky Division of Water will be tightening a belt that's already been tight, and it's going to be difficult for them to not replace people. They have a high turnover at this point, and they need good qualified people as well. So a budget cut for them is going to be difficult to maintain.
We had a question about water filters. Is it a wise thing to purchase water filters, a whole house filter for your home, the one you put on the kitchen sink, one you put on the ice maker on the refrigerator, or just the ones that you put in the refrigerator and refill? Are those effective and helpful?
Yes, water filters for the home are very effective. The thing is that the homeowner needs to make sure they maintain it. If they don't follow the recommendation of the manufacturer, they could cause a bigger problem by not maintaining it. They could get a bigger dose of what they're trying to prevent with this filter if it's not properly taken care of.
So when it says replace this filter after 30 days or so many gallons of water, don't be a cheapskate.
Yes.
Right. And some of the filters can clog quicker. It's kind of under normal use, under most conditions, it may be 30 days. It depends on the filter. But waters that have higher concentrations of contaminants, the filters may clog more quickly and might warrant being changed more frequently.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Water quality is our topic. 800-621-8890. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com is our email. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. We are down to the last 8 minutes of the show. So if you've got a question you want answered, get in here right away. Jason Marion and Donna McNeil are here with us live on Thursday morning. This message came in, whether it's an email or a tweet, hard for me to tell sometimes here, but it came in asking, I grew up in eastern Kentucky in the Pineville, Middlesboro area. Many were on wells with high sulfur content. Is there any evidence of health issues related to that water? I've heard that eastern just has a high rate of gallbladder issues.
Well, with respect to the sulfur, some people like it in their water, but personally, I don't like the taste of raw eggs in my water. But the toxicology and the epidemiological studies, those are health studies that look for disease frequency, hasn't found a lot of evidence that suggests that high sulfur will necessarily cause health problems. The U.S. EPA for public water providers does not have what they call a primary standard or a maximum contaminant level for sulfur, for like sulfates in particular, because of the lack of health effects. They have a secondary standard that's really high. It's like 250 milligrams per liter. That's a lot of sulfur before they would say that the water would be a nuisance or difficult to taste or have such a bad smell that people would be annoyed by it so much that they wouldn't drink it. So with respect to the high levels of sulfur, that's not necessarily a problem. But sometimes we see that the high levels of sulfur in some parts of the state are in areas where the pH may be really low, and that may allow other things to be in the water. So if the sulfur is high, that might not be a problem, but there could be other things that might be among the sulfur that's in the water that we can't smell. So nobody knows that they have high lead or high mercury because you can't smell it or taste it. Very, very low levels of those things in the water, particularly the lead, you're measuring things down in the part per billion range, and we don't know about them. But with sulfur, I think you're in good shape if it's in the water. That's still okay.
To what extent should we go by smell or taste of the drinking water? I know you move from one community to another and you go, oh, this tastes different than what I'm used to. That's not necessarily a problem, I assume. You're telling me that we put things in because of what needs to be treated. What if the water tastes like chlorine? Well, what if you do get some brown stuff coming out when you open up the tap? And I've always heard, oh, yeah, no problem. Just let it run and you'll be fine. When do you, as a homeowner, or you move into a new community, start, using the local water utility? When do you raise those questions?
Anytime you have a question about the look of the water or the smell of the water, you should be calling your water utility. They're there as a public service. It's part of their process. As a professional, they should be able to answer those questions, and it may be a concern. Discolored water is a concern. That utility may have been flushing lines to get rid of discolored water sometimes, and they're supposed to notify utilities or supposed to notify their customers to make them aware of that situation so that when you get home in that evening, you can flush your lines and get rid of the discolored water that's in those lines. If there is a public health concern, they will notify the public. That a boil water advisory, for example, if they've had a line break that they've lost chlorine residual or it's taken them longer than 8 hours to repair the break or the loss of pressure. All those things are an issue that water utilities are to take very high responsibility for.
And when a boil water advisory is issued, after you boil that water, do you feel like that water is now safe, or there's still, with all the treatment you're talking about here, I'm wondering why boiling alone is acceptable?
Yeah.
If there was something more of a concern, if it wasn't bacterial that was a concern, the utility would tell that water system, that customer, what is going on. That's part of that public participation and public notification process. If for example, in eastern Kentucky, they had the coal slurry issue, those were other concerns that may have been an issue. If it's something like an arsenic issue or that, it's just like in Flint, Michigan, those customers have been told not to drink the water. Instead of a boil water advisory, you would have a consumer advisory telling them to not drink the water.
One email from a listener earlier in the program, John wrote, he was asking about testing of water, but he also raises the question of, in the microcephaly crisis in Brazil, there have been concerns raised about chemicals like larvicides, especially piriproxifen. What kinds of water regulation limits are in place by Kentucky and EPA on pesticides and herbicides? I guess it's possible for pesticides and herbicides to get into our water supplies?
It is possible, and they are actually, they do monitor for those. I was trying to see. I actually had some standards that I brought with me, but I didn't dig that deep into the organic standards. But yeah, there are concerns even, I mean, there were a group of doctors in Brazil that suggested that the larvicides may have been responsible, but I think other countries are starting to investigate whether or not the larvicides, what the cause of. There's still a lot of debate about whether or not that's an issue, but organics in our water in general, it could even not just be the pesticides, but there could have been an old spill. There could have been some sort of solvent used for degreasing things in an old drum that was left somewhere, and those things can persist in the environment for a really, really long time. Usually there's tests where they look for total organics, and if the total organics are negligible, then we have no reason to believe that any of those other ones would be there in high enough levels to cause a problem. It's hard to get in the game of let's look for every single individual pesticide and every single chemical, because we'd be in this business for a long time just testing one water sample.
We're just about out of time, but of course, you know, we hear these stories about high levels of mercury in fish. Don't eat locally caught fish. There's talk about, you know, limiting the amount of fish that you catch and eat. Gosh, do we need to be concerned about the water that when we hear about that issue in the water that the fish live in?
Part of that deals with the raw water analysis that's done up front on these water systems. The treatment process that is approved to be put in place should take care of all those issues. So I feel pretty comfortable about the water quality in Kentucky. Feel confident in our regulated community. The 99.9% compliance rate is astounding. The main concern in Kentucky right now has to deal with disinfection byproducts. That is, especially with consecutive systems where we have merged a lot of systems. But overall, I think we're doing a really good job in Kentucky.
And we'll end on that note with asking also again for the resources listeners can turn to check their water quality. Is there places they can send their water to? Where do they go online to find out how to get their water tested?
We'll be glad to provide that.
At your site?
We'll provide. Yeah, I'll put that together
and
for you.
I'll put my email together, jason.marion@eku.edu. I'm sure it'll be on the WEKU website
exactly.
As well. And, you know, I try my best to answer some questions that come in. If I get flooded, we'll see what we can do.
We'll fire them off to you if we get them by email to Jason Marion and Donna McNeil. Thank you so much for a very informative conversation
thank
on
you,
this
John.
Week's program. We want to thank Noah Day for producing this week's program, with the assistance of our other student producers. Brian Bartlett has been at the controls. We have had help from Logan Riley and from Andrew Moorhead as well, and Brian Burkhart. Eastern Standard is a production of WEKU at Eastern Kentucky University. The program will be repeating on Sunday evening, and you can find the podcast at weku.fm.